Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
My special guest today is Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Today we're discussing SGX launching the first international REIT futures for Asia. These products are based on REITs listed in Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia and Thailand. Now, what are REIT futures exactly? We're going to get to the ins and outs of that. Meanwhile, the Fed is expected to make a major commitment to ramping up inflation soon. What you need to understand about that as an investor. And gold, well, it breached a historic high yesterday, going beyond the $2,000 a troy ounce mark. I've been bullish on gold since 2018 when the price was $1,260. You're very welcome. All right, we'll discuss all these topics and more. First up, good morning, Arun.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
I'm doing well. All right, let's talk about those two international REIT futures that SGX is launching. These are based on indices tracking REITs listed in Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Thailand. The SGX is launching an SGX FTSE EPRA Nareit Asia X Japan Index Future, say that three times fast and I'll give you $50, as well as the SGX iEdge S REIT Leaders Index Futures. Okay, let's break this down for the listener. We know that REITs are very popular amongst investors, but first up, what is a REIT future? How does it work?
Sure. So firstly, taking a step back even before that is just a REIT, right? Like a REIT is nothing but a company that is sitting and managing a whole bunch of properties. It could be commercial, could be residential, industrial, you name it. And the law states that of all the earnings, at least 90% have to be allocated to investors, which basically leads to a relatively high headline dividend rate, which is very attractive for retail investors.
Yes.
Now, these are nothing but just something like a Microsoft stock or Apple stock, but in the form of a real estate investment trust. When you come to REIT futures, it is a derivative, which means that when you start trading REIT futures, you have the advantage of potentially taking on a lot more leverage, which is good and bad, obviously. And the way a single stock future or the way a REIT future works is it can kind of, the tradable price is to a certain date. What I mean by that is, as of today, which is 6th of August, there will be a certain finite time frame or an expiry of that future, which you can trade to. So typically, like in gold, in any commodity, in single stock futures, you will have either monthly or quarterly expiry for that specific future. So it could be like March calendar, quarterly ending, July quarterly ending, etc., future date. So what you're doing is you're buying and selling that underlying to that certain price for that certain finite date in the future. That's how a REIT future works.
Can you short it?
You can short it, indeed. So the beauty is for futures is you can take leverage, and that directly means that you can short the future also in a much more easier fashion than a single name stock where you need to have a certain number of shares outstanding and there's a certain cost of carrying, et cetera. It becomes a lot easier for retail investors to be able to do that in the future space.
So are you receiving anything? We know there was this big hoo-ha because of the oil futures contracts expiring and people wondering where to store oil, right? So
that
how does that work here?
Over here, it doesn't, because unlike a commodity future where the terms are its deliverable, which means you have to roll the future as and when you come close to that expiry date, you need to roll the future into the next contract, if that is what the investor chooses to do so. In the case of a single stock future, you can obviously choose to roll that future also, or you just get given that stock. Unlike a commodity where typical investors, do not have a massive warehouse space to take delivery of like hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil, in their brokerage account, they will just get delivery of that stock. So there's no issues in terms of it suddenly going negative or anything like that, which is what we faced in the oil space a couple of months back.
Okay. How might investors use a REIT future as a hedging instrument. Is it effective?
So it really depends on the very specific nature of the future. Because the reason I say that is, when it comes to these specific single name futures, they might not be the most interesting instruments or the most adequate instruments for hedging purposes. The reason I say that is because you're dealing with a lot of very specific risks pertaining to that company's name. So a good example is, say you're very bullish Apple and Amazon, okay, right? And you think that will outperform the market substantially. So what a retail investor can do is buy stocks of like the underlying Apple and Amazon, and then go and short the three-month forward future of the S&P 500. So then it becomes an immediate like outperformance play where the view of the investor is, over the course of the next 3 months, I understand there's going to be a lot of uncertainty in the market, but I believe these two tech behemoths will be able to outperform the market. Mm. So I go long the stock and I go short the future. Mm. When you come to single name stock futures, you're really taking a position on that specific single name. So it's not like something where you can go long a bunch of maple trees and a bunch of other real estate investment trusts through their stock underlying, but then go shorting a single name REIT future 3 months in the future, because you really need to be concerned about the individual risk, the idiosyncratic risk of individual stock names or future names.
Okay, help us understand what the differences are between these two products that the Singapore Exchange is set to launch. So these are REITs that are based on indexes.
That is correct. So index futures in this specific case, instead of single name stocks, you're taking a more macro view of the entire sector. Mm-hmm. And these two sectors, especially the FTSE EPRA Nareit Global Real Estate Index, mm-hmm, it has something like $350 billion of assets that is tracking that. So in terms of a view of the REIT sector overall, this is a very overall, like all-encompassing, index future. So in this case, what an investor can do is, if they want to take a relative outperformance play between a very specific single name, like say a Cromwell Euro REIT, mm-hmm, which is also listed on the SGX, because mm-hmm, I'm very, a person or an investor can be very bullish European real estate. Mm-hmm. They go long that, and then they go short the future of that, FTSE EPRA Nareit Global Real Estate Index series, mm-hmm, and they can play that kind of outperformance play. So from that perspective, hedging could be quite interesting to retail investors who want to try and monetize that very specific view.
I see. Okay. So in terms of the FTSE EPRA Nareit Global Real Estate Index series and the iEdge SREIT Leaders Index, what do you see as the key differences?
So in the case of the FTSE Global one, it's a much larger index where you have, like under $500 million worth of assets tracking it. Mm. The iEdge SREIT is more of a localized Singapore REIT market, where instead of taking individual REIT exposures in the SGX exchange, SGX has given a very easy way out for retail investors who have access to the local burst, where they can just purchase this one single future and they get exposure to the entire SREIT market.
Okay. What is your sense of interest, possible interest for this product among Singaporean investors? We know Singaporeans love REITs because of their dependable dividends, at least in a pre-COVID world. But these contracts are different animals, since you'll be looking to changes in share price, right?
So I think it's an interesting time that SGX decided to release this product, because, mm, we talked about the whole MSCI suite of indices being pulled away from SGX.
Yes.
I think it was about a month or 2 months ago. And we were discussing at that time too, that SGX really has to start coming up with more innovative products to keep the investor base interested in its underlying. Now, obviously, there's been a massive tailwind of retail investors who have been day trading, which leads to SGX having a lot more churn of volume, thereby leading to higher trading fees, and that's showcased in the results of the stock too. But the issue with SGX very specifically is that, unlike Hong Kong, it doesn't have the backing of elderly, fatherly figure that will always start providing it. There will always be a pipeline of IPOs for the exchange. Mm. So over the past year or two, all the big marquee names, especially courtesy of the U.S.-China trade war, they've been delisting from the U.S., relisting in Hong Kong potentially, or a couple of the more local exchanges in China. They've not come to Singapore because it just doesn't have that kind of brand reputation or the history for that. So there are a lot of things that even the NAS is doing, trying to help the local economy by setting up like a variable capital company where you will start seeing a lot more hedge funds coming and being based out of here rather than Bermuda and stuff. On the other side, on the offering side, SGX needs to continue to innovate and trying to ensure, even if IPOs don't get set up over here, there is a relatively easy way for, be it retail investors or hedge fund investors, to have that kind of depth of liquidity and volume to be able to take exposure to various asset classes across the globe just sitting onshore in Singapore. And that's what something that I think the SGX has been doing really, really well, especially after the MSCI index pulled its suite of funds.
Okay, so a lot of investors interested in shares of SGX will be wondering, is this going to make up for some business SGX is losing because of those MSCI contracts that went to Hong Kong?
Most definitely. I mean, if you look at the share price, I think it had crashed from like close to 10 down to 8, so like about a 20% drop. Mm. And now it's inching back all the way up to like $9. Mm. So, you know, obviously there are some short-term tailwinds of these retail investors trading. But I think from a long-term perspective, if the SGX can continue to innovate, coming up with new products that has global exposure, because the Singapore economy is just too small to attract the attention of like a $500 billion hedge fund to come and set up shop over here. Mm. Yes. The tax structure, the ease of setting up corporate governance, et cetera, is fantastic. But they still need avenues to be able to deploy that sizable amount of capital. So as long as SGX can continue to have tie-ups with other foreign exchanges, coming up with their own innovative products, catering to the local investor class, hopefully we'll be able to see the share price rebound. But that being said, it is on the more expensive side still.
He's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, helping me digest and make sense of what markets are talking about or people in the markets are talking about. Let's talk about the Fed policy. The Fed is working on a policy that will commit it to low interest rates for years to come. So the goal is to ensure higher inflation, sounds weird, perhaps to avoid deflation and a return to full employment. So one change will be the use of the phrase average inflation. This means inflation above the central bank's usual 2% target, tolerated, even desired. So why would the Fed be pursuing this new policy?
So it's quite an interesting announcement that took place over the last couple of days, and the Fed has been researching this for over a year, with the final complete results yet to be announced, but this is the initial guidance that they've given to the market. What the Fed used to do is taking the Phillips curve approach, where they were trying to forecast inflation. The whole rationale, as you were rightfully mentioning, is as unemployment comes down, inflation goes up. And that's how they'll be able to try and control interest rates to ensure that the economy doesn't get overheated, or they can drop interest rates quite substantially if you know, that is happening, and trying to like boost aggregate demand and start to boost inflation. What's happened over the past 10, 12 years, let's just take a step back before COVID. Post the global financial crisis, the Fed dropped interest rates to basically zero, right? Between zero and 0.25. And there was just very small green shoots of inflation. It started inching up closer to above 2%. I think the maximum it went up to was like just about 3%. And then the Fed, trying to take preemptive measures to ensure that inflation doesn't get out of control, they started increasing interest rates. The market decided to puke at that news when they were like, okay, the punch bowl is being taken away from us. This is not the right way to do it. And they really pressurized the Fed to start, you know, even before COVID, to like really start analyzing what's happening over here and to start dropping interest rates further again. But the kind of crazy thing, in my humble opinion, is the market is being quite short-sighted, because taking a further step back, why did the global financial crisis even happen? And this is when Alan Greenspan actually came out, and he himself admitted that interest rates were kept for far too low for far too long post the dot-com bubble crash. So when you lead interest rates to being too low for an extended period of time, asset bubbles start forming in some way, shape, or the other, because people are incentivized to lever up because the cost of capital is so low and go about trying to buy something.
Right.
And what happened in 2008 is literally a person who was, you know, working as a burrito server in a Mexican restaurant in Atlanta, in my university city, was sitting and buying like three or four properties, giving zero down payment, flipping them in a couple of months and making a very decent killing on that.
Wow.
But then then came the massive crash where you're stuck with all these properties. You need to start paying those variable interest rate mortgages. And then you have to file for bankruptcy because there's just no other way out because you don't have that kind of capital base. So when you start coming down to this interest rate being low, so now what has the Fed done? The Fed is like, unemployment through the roof right now, courtesy COVID, which is hopefully going to be a relatively short term. By short term, I mean over the next 6 months to hopefully 2 years. But at the same time, inflation is not, even before this, inflation had not truly risen to a point where it was enough of a concern, technically. So now what they're going to do is, rather than forecasting future inflation, they're going to take what the actual inflation was in the past. And that can cause certain problems because once inflation starts spiking up and if it starts getting out of control, the way that interest rates will have to suddenly spike up will take us back to like the 70s, I believe, in the U.S., where Volcker had to start raising interest rates close to like 12 or 14%. So no one knows where this is actually going to go. And not for a second am I saying that we will potentially even nearly go back to that doomsday scenario. Mm-hmm. But with these signals that the Fed has given, it's a very clear light, in a way, to investors to do a couple of things. Okay. Firstly, the U.S. currency will continue to devalue itself against other currencies because the Fed is definitely going to keep interest rates low. You would rather collect certain amount of yield from other currencies. Unless, of course, there's a massive spike in COVID cases again, there's a doomsday scenario, and then people will again start trusting the U.S. over any other developed or developing economy. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one thing. Gold, which you know you were highlighting in the beginning of the show, the reason why it went up to 2,000 for a whole host of other factors, one of the main ones is the fact that the U.S. dollar is depreciating against a whole host of other currencies. So where do investors start parking their assets? Thirdly, treasury inflation-protected securities. A lot of capital has gone into these because with investors knowing that this is the one sole focus of the Fed right now to ensure that interest rates are going to be kept extremely minimal, leading to a higher inflation rate, a lot of money has gone into these types of securities. And lastly, something that we've been seeing over the past, I would say, 2 to 3 months, given the kind of pandemic that we're right in the middle of, a lot of investors have pumped money into equities because you're not going to put money into cash because it's 0% interest pretty much across the globe. Mm-hmm. You're not going to put money into bonds because your interest rates are basically zero over there too. I think Google issued like a 5-year note or 5-year bond at something like 0.5% or something, like some insane amount, insanely low amount. And the only thing left, the only game left in town is equities. So we're seeing a lot of investors just pumping money into the equity space because there literally is nowhere else to go. How that will end, no one knows. But rest be assured, if you keep interest rates low for an extended period of time, asset bubbles will be forming in some way, shape, or the other. One can only hope that it doesn't lead to a systemic crisis the way the global financial crisis did to the entire world economy.
Thank you. Such a considered response to that, which could have, substantial investing implications, the Fed's policy and proposed policy. I wish we had more time to get into it. But I want to talk about gold, which has hit a historic high, now trading at $2,041 an ounce. So it's gone past that 2011 historic benchmark. Can you share with us, are we peaking? Is it a bad time to buy gold?
You know, it's truly impossible to say because how do you value gold other than another investor being willing to buy it at a price higher than what you purchased it for, right? Because and that might sound like a Ponzi scheme, but sadly, what true value can you derive out of it? It doesn't provide a dividend. Hmm. It sits there nice and shiny. Like, to be honest, like real gold doesn't even shine. But anyway, let's just say it sits in a corner in a nice shiny manner. And the investor can only hope that the price will keep appreciating. But that being said, though, there are many valid reasons for why gold is where it's at. One of which we just talked about a couple of minutes back, which is the fact that the U.S. dollar, interest rates are so low. The Fed is going to keep interest rates so low. U.S. dollar is getting devalued against other currencies. A couple of other reasons, you know, the uncertainty, COVID. Sure, equity assets, equity prices are rallying like crazy because of the other reasons that we mentioned. But at the same time, a more frugal, careful investor, a prudent investor will say, okay, wait a minute, we're in the middle of a crazy pandemic. Gold is something that has been relatively inflation-linked over the past 200 years. I'm not going to go against this massive mega trend. Huh. I'm going to start piling into gold. So from that perspective, it does make sense. Interest rates are low, so there's no cost of carrying gold versus, say, cash. Uncertainty of COVID, it is a relatively good inflation hedge, purely because of the fact that a whole host of investors believe in that. And I think one thing that Goldman touched on a couple of days back is, will the U.S. dollar remain the reserve currency of the world?
Yes. And that is
a very, very scary situation because of all of our lifetimes, you know, the U.S. dollar, like you trust in the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
But now with this massive dichotomy between the U.S.-China trade war, this huge divergence there, you know, like is the U.S. holding the world ransom to all of its financial measures? Like you can't use it. You can't use SWIFT, which is the payment channel for U.S. dollars. And then maybe the world is coming up to realize that, okay, China is growing. There's a massive domestic economy there. We have to appease them. Maybe we should start forming a lot more contracts in the yuan. And how will that lead? And this is not something like the next 2 years, 5 years, but over a much more longer time horizon, it's something that should be kept in the back of investors' minds, I feel.
I love these fireside chats with you, Arun. I learned so much. So, you know, do you think FOMO is going to be a powerful force then for gold? I mean, do you think it's going to go to 3,000?
You know, I wish I could tell.
But I have to ask.
I do think, though, if the world, it's interesting because if the world goes down a very, very dangerous negative path, then one can easily envision a very clear scenario for gold to spike a lot higher. On the flip side, with interest rates remaining zero, the U.S. dollar not doing so well against any currency, and then you're dealing with like esoteric risks of how is Europe going to perform, how is Asia going to perform, etc. One can clearly see a path of why a lot of investors are interested in that asset class. So I'm not sure at what price. I don't know how to value gold personally, but I can see why there's a lot of interest in that specific asset class.
I wanted to talk about Disney, but I have no time. Instead, we're going to talk about the Kwok family, Hong Kong's richest family. They've lost $8 billion in a single year. They are behind Hong Kong's largest property empire. So, battered by Hong Kong's political crises and economic crises, shares of the Kwok family's Soon Hung Kai properties are trading at less than half the NAV, the value of the company's net assets value, within a hair's breadth of the most depressed level on record, begging the question, is it a good time to buy Soon Hung Kai shares?
They have been absolutely hammered along with the entire industry, right? Because of the various factors of universal suffrage, the democratic movement, being stuck between Hong Kong and between China and the US. The entire economy in Hong Kong has just taken an absolute beating. The other factor, though, which is also playing in the minds of investors, I feel, or it should definitely play in the mind, is given this new security law, a lot of the much larger onshore China developers are now getting a lot more confident that they will be able to exert their their power on the Hong Kong market also. So like I believe the two recent large land transfers or land purchases that have taken place recently are by the in Hong Kong are by these large Chinese developers. So Hong Kong developers are now getting killed from all sides. A weak economy, a weak balance sheet, hence they're trading at like half book value. The entrance of these massive competitors who have much larger balance sheets than them. Now, the flip side would be, oh, okay, if that's the case, then maybe Hong Kong developers have a really solid access into Chinese markets. Mm. But the problem is they don't have the kind of relationship which is essential to try and build your business to a much larger scale in China that the Chinese developers have. So it's an extremely difficult spot. But it's funny where I look at it more from an investor point of view.
Yes.
I was talking to a friend's father who's in the hotel business. And he was saying, I think you're looking at this all wrong because Hong Kong is like the poster boy of China. That's the one city where the world is looking to China and saying, wow, you have done such a phenomenal job of this place with the whole, you know, two systems, one country kind of aspect. Will China ever let Hong Kong go down? And to which I was like, oh, you know what? That's a very valid point. Maybe they won't. So he's actually quite bullish China, which is contrary to a lot of the finance people that I talk to who are, you know, these investment bankers are like, you know what? I'm just going to pack my bags and leave because I don't believe in the future of Hong Kong. So it'll be a very interesting, tug of war of how this is going to occur in the next 5 to 10 years. So it'll be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I guess it goes to how you read the long-term value of Soon Hung Kai's assets, portfolio of office towers and shopping malls and hotels, and whether or not it's going to integrate Hong Kong with China. That's going to, I suppose, affect the stock's performance. Let's see how it's traded so far. It is currently trading at $95.60 Hong Kong cents. Arun, before we let you go, what is on your Singapore stocks to watch list?
Oh, I like banks to some extent. I know they've taken a bit of a beating, courtesy yes. MAS, courtesy the whole MAS law or the, you know, the regulation or whatever their advice to try and cap your dividends and stuff. So I think that could be an interesting play. In terms of 5G, there are a number of companies relating to either AEM Holdings, UMS, definitely on the pricey side, but they easily have, I think, some amount of fair runway to go through over there. Other than that, personally, you know, I don't think there's too many more attractive avenues to try and deploy capital in the Singapore market, or for that matter, in equity in general. So I'm taking a little bit more of a prudent approach personally and keeping some, you know, dry gunpowder for the future.
All right. Always rich insights you have for us, Arun. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle, for having me.
Have a wonderful Thursday. He's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, right here on Money and Me.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at MoneyFM893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.